Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with next week's trip to Asia that a reluctant traveller, President Trump, is undertaking, with a tour of the Pearl Harbor Memorial in Hawaii, then on to Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam for the APEC Summit of World Leaders, and lastly the Philippines, where he's already cutting short his visit and skipping the East Asia Summit being held there. The Director of East and Southeast Asia Policy at the Center for American Progress, Brian Harding, joins us from Japan. He served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as Country Director for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs, and we will discuss Trump's reality TV show Tease when asked whether he will visit the DMZ separating the two Koreas, and the possibility that the North Koreans will upstage Trump with a nuclear or missile test. We'll also look into whether or not Trump will meet with Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the APEC summit in Vietnam and assess what might be achieved by the 12-day trip, which Trump has already shortened, as he did earlier with his first foreign trip abroad, about which he expressed dread and cut from 9 days to 5. Then we will speak with Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis, about his article at Politico, "Are Trump's Generals In Over Their Heads?" and his article at the American Conservative, "How Saddam Hussein Predicted America's Failure in Iraq," which is a chapter in his new book, The Pentagon Wars. We'll assess whether there has been too much expectation placed on the generals around Trump, the so-called adults in the room, and examine how much the deeply conservative and politically inexperienced Chief of Staff John Kelly is way out of his depth. Then finally, we'll look into the country that most Americans just learned the U.S. military is involved in, Niger. A former Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Niamey, Niger, David Litt, joins us. He was a State Department political advisor to the U.S. Special Operations Command from 1998 to 2002, and we will discuss his article at Foreign Policy, "Why is the United States in Niger Anyway?" and how, in a region where it is easier to get an AK-47 assault rifle than a job, weak governance and poverty makes the region a fertile ground for insurgents. And joining us now from Japan is Brian Harding, the Director of East and Southeast Asia Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. From 2009 to 2013, he served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as Country Director for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Harding.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I guess you're ahead of Donald Trump there by a week, but he is on his way next week to Hawaii, then Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam for the APEC summit, and then lastly, the Philippines. He's already cutting the trip short. What is your sense about this reluctant traveler? Because he cut his first foreign trip abroad from 9 days to 5.
Yeah, well, first of all, the reason for the timing of the trip this month is because the APEC summit will be held in Vietnam and the East Asia summit will be held in the Philippines. Asian leaders try to batch these two meetings together to make it more convenient for the President of the United States to come to Asia and attend all these meetings. Trump elected to add on Japan, South Korea, and China to the beginning of his trip. So once you pulled it all together, it was 12 days. And it's really beyond me why he chose to spend so much time before the two summits, including 3 full days in Beijing, rather than staying through to the end to make sure that he attended the East Asia summit, not attending which is really diplomatic malpractice.
So what's your sense then of what these earlier days are going to achieve? And we know that he's sort of berated and beaten up the Chinese and his own Secretary of State, leaning on them to sort of get our irons out of the fire, or his irons out of the fire in North Korea. My understanding is that the North Koreans and the Chinese hate each other and that it's always been a fool's errand. So what's the 3-day trip if it's not about North Korea?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd say is that he's actually hitting the mark correctly by visiting Tokyo and Seoul first on this trip. There are a range of challenges in the region, not just North Korea, but you really can't accomplish anything in Asia as the United States without close alliance partnership. So it's totally appropriate that he's visiting Japan and South Korea on this trip. In my mind, the China visit is a bit of an elective. And on that stop, I think North Korea is definitely going to be at the top of the agenda. The problem is that Trump has made a bet that by somehow playing nice with China on second, third, fourth order issues, that somehow they're going to be tougher on North Korea. Frankly, I think that's a fool's errand. We should actually be working more intensively with China on some of the other difficult issues in the relationship, such as trade in the South China Sea.
Well, what's your sense then of whether or not there'll be anything achieved vis-a-vis North Korea? If he goes to South Korea first, there, of course, would be collateral damage in any military exchange. And I just spoke the other day to a former U.S. ambassador to South Korea who said he's more afraid of Donald Trump than he is of Kim Jong-un. So I believe, at least I've read reports from South Korea, that people are quite nervous there. They recognize that they're, you know, literally at the front line of a possible exchange.
In terms of the visit to Seoul, the measure of success is actually pretty simple. Do the United States and South Korea appear to be on the same page, or do they not? There cannot be a successful North Korea policy that doesn't involve a rock-solid U.S.-South Korea alliance. And right now, that's a bit wobbly. And Donald Trump, by threatening to pull out of the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, by belittling President Moon in South Korea, has really created some uncertainty. It's really everything that North Korea and China might want. So this is an important effort to patch things up. And if Trump can stay on script, including in his address to the Korean parliament, I think that would actually be a great step forward.
Well, we don't have an ambassador to South Korea either. I mean, there is a certain negligence around the world in terms of staffing, both at the DOD, state, and on the National Security Council. But in terms of the first trip to Japan, just there was a meeting in the Philippines just a few days ago with the defense ministers of South Korea and Japan, and with General Mattis, they're expressing alarm about North Korea. And recently, General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, said that there are military options. So do you think that there will be any kind of mischief from the North Koreans? I mean, they upstaged Xi when he last hosted a group of world leaders by letting off their thermonuclear bomb. Do you think he could do something to upstage Donald Trump? Because he's sort of been doing this reality TV tease about whether or not he'll visit the DMZ. So my sense is that something could happen on the North Korean side.
That's certainly possible. And in reference to the comments by General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, I mean, this is my primary concern, that somehow these guys have convinced themselves that there's some sort of good military option. We've been looking for military options against North Korea for the last 30 years at least, and there hasn't been one that doesn't involve incredible, you know, catastrophic damage to South Korea and elsewhere in the region. My worry is that since day one, Donald Trump has been asking for military options, asking again, and these guys seem to have convinced themselves that there's some sort of small-scale strike that could teach North Korea a lesson, in which you could contain the aftermath. But I think with President Trump's temperament, with combined with Kim Jong-un, it's very hard to think that there's a situation that could be contained politically once the first strikes happen. And that's my biggest worry.
Well, assuming that we get past the South Korean visit and get to the APEC summit in Vietnam, without the world blowing up, what do you expect to happen there? Because a lot of people are wondering about whether or not he'll meet with Vladimir Putin on the sidelines. Of course, that would get a great deal of scrutiny, to say the least, right?
Right. And I mean, the United States and Russia certainly have a relationship in the Pacific, but that would be an occasion to talk about issues not particularly germane to the Asia-Pacific. I think we need to remember that APEC is, at the end of the day, an economic forum. The entire Asia-Pacific region is wondering what the United States brings to the table these days after having withdrawn from the TPP and not really articulating any sort of vision for economic engagement with Asia. On the economic front, Trump's team has really been singularly focused on making some superficial deals to superficially reduce U.S. bilateral trade balances with Asian partners. They want to hear that the United States understands that this is the most dynamic economic region in the world, and it will be for decades, and that the United States is here to play.
Well, you mentioned earlier that skipping the East Asia summit in the Philippines is a diplomatic malpractice. What is he missing? I know he's going to meet with Duterte, and Duterte is a pretty controversial figure, to put it mildly, or even to understate the obvious, that he's got a lot of blood on his hands.
Yeah, so there's three components to the Philippines visit, or there should be. One is a bilateral visit with the Filipino president, Rodrigo Duterte. The second is a U.S.-ASEAN summit, which it's the 50th anniversary of U.S.-ASEAN relations, and that's an important thing to do. The third component is the East Asia summit, which is the premier venue, the only time of the year where the leaders of 18 Asia-Pacific countries come together to talk about political security issues. And it really is malpractice for the United States not to be at the table for that meeting.
Well, that's the one that he's cut. And, you know, he's as you say, he's added earlier stuff, and he's visiting the Pearl Harbor Memorial in Hawaii, I guess almost like a rest stop on the way. What's the logic behind that? Who's advising him?
I think the White House has come out and said that they're worried that the president is going to be cranky at the end of this visit. I can imagine that. The East Asia Summit is not the most exciting thing in the world, and I don't think Donald Trump would actually enjoy his time there, but it's important for the president of the United States to be in that seat. The real problem here is that he added all of these additional stops and days, and I just can't tell you why he could visit Hawaii or spend a third day in Beijing and not attend the East Asia Summit in Manila.
Well, I guess we'll find out, and there may be other shoes that drop on the way. As I mentioned in the opening, he is clearly the reluctant traveler. He may well be the reluctant president.
Yeah.
But I thank you for joining us.
Sure. And thank you very much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Brian Harding, who is in Japan. He's the director of East and Southeast Asia Policy at the Center for American Progress. And from 2009 to 2013, he served in the office of the Secretary of Defense as Country Director for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. Take a brief station break. We'll be back assessing how the deeply conservative and politically inexperienced Chief of Staff General John Kelly is way out of his depth. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies, and his latest book just out is The Pentagon Wars. And he has an article at Politico, Are Trump's Generals In Over Their Heads?, and another at The American Conservative, How Saddam Hussein Predicted America's Failure in Iraq, which is, I believe, a part of the Pentagon Wars book, is it not?
Yes, that's right. It's an excerpt from a chapter of the book.
So, where do we start, Mark? I mean, let me start with the Military Times just had a poll that came out, I think, yesterday, saying that 53% of serving U.S. military officers do not support their commander-in-chief, Donald Trump.
Yeah, I was surprised by the number. I'm not surprised that that's a general feeling, but I thought the number would probably be still in the 40s, which is what I looked at last time. And the answer is very simple. I don't think this is a character issue. I don't think it's a tweet issue. I think that what the rank and file, the enlisted personnel in the military are concerned about are the continuing serial deployments of American forces overseas. You know, it's like any other institution. It gets tired. And we've been 16 years in Afghanistan. There's very little faith among the military, even the senior military, that we can somehow win and perhaps not even draw. We're still in Iraq. We're now in Syria. And we just had four of our American soldiers killed in Niger. And I think that what this poll shows is a general across-the-board exhaustion with these wars among the military. After all, they voted 80% for Trump because they supported his view that the United States military should not be involved in nation building. And lo and behold, they think, here we are again.
Well, it's particularly ironic, is it not, though, that General Kelly is now embroiled in a political scandal where he went to Trump's rescue and he effectively got slimed. But the fact that John Kelly, the Marine general, lost his son in Afghanistan, and that became an issue in this to and fro about the disrespect or the alleged disrespect that the president paid towards the widow of the slain Green Beret from Niger. How much does that pay? You say that the military are tired of deployments, but they must also be wondering, what the hell was this war in Afghanistan all about, America's longest war? And what were the sacrifices worth? You know, what do we have to show for it?
Well, General Kelly is a throwback. He's a very deeply conservative, social conservative person. He was a great combat officer and one of the best, and it's right to honor his service. But as they say in the military, he's out of his lane. He has 4 years of experience being a combat infantry officer and absolutely zero in doing what he has to do, which is to organize the president's schedule, be political, glad hand with members of Congress, speak to the press openly and fairly, watch his language. I mean, can you imagine what would have happened if Leon Panetta, for instance, had given that briefing? We would not be here now. It's just a case of, here is a military officer who's not trained to do what he's doing now. And I think it's showing. He's a throwback. He's a dyed-in-the-wool Marine, and they have definite opinions, and they're never afraid to express them, no matter how conservative they are. And that's not good politics. So I think he made a mistake, and it shows.
But do you think that liberals made a mistake in thinking that because there's some adult supervision, as Senator Corker describes it, having these generals containing Trump, that liberals somehow thought because Kelly was doing what was needed, he was therefore one of them, when in fact, as you point out, he's deeply conservative. He may have a lot more in common with Trump's policies than people realize.
Well, I think you're exactly right, but there were a lot of us in the press looking over our shoulder, wondering why everyone was applauding this man. I mean, listen, he's a perfectly fine man, but he's just not cut out for this job. I think that progressives were hoping that, you know, adult supervision would kick in, and what they're finding out is that, you know, these military officers, Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly, have just as many blemishes, though perhaps not as deeply ensconced as our commander-in-chief. And it's quite a surprise to a lot of people. You know, I'd hate to say it, but after the Kelly press conference, it appears that the people in charge of the daycare center, as Senator Corker would say, probably need some daycare themselves. They're just not that sophisticated politically, and I suspect, and I think that this is largely what you're getting at, they're a little out of step with the enlisted personnel, the privates, corporals, and sergeants in the military, who are a little bit more fed up than they are with these wars, and I think that begins to take its toll.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Perry, who's an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies, and his latest book just out is The Pentagon Wars. He has an article at Politico, Are Trump's Generals in Over Their Heads?, and another at The American Conservative, How Saddam Hussein Predicted America's Failure in Iraq. Let's turn to that article, which is a chapter in your new book, Mark Perry, The Pentagon Wars. It just is, at this point, the Iraq situation is the gift that keeps on not giving, yeah. but bleeding. You know, it's just the open yeah. wound. It just seems like no end in sight, and it just gets worse and worse. And now, with the Iranian-backed militias taking Kirkuk, they've basically taken the economic lifeline away from Iraqi Kurdistan, where the U.S. has found that the Iraqi Kurds and the Syrian Kurds are the only boots on the ground that have been of any use in the war against the Islamic State. And this is obviously yet another victory for Iran. My understanding with Saddam Hussein was one of the reasons he simply up to the very end didn't believe the Americans were going to invade, because he couldn't believe they'd be that stupid, because they, if you get rid of me, it's a gift to the Iranians. But somehow that message never got through to our people.
Well, you're exactly right. And I can recall in 2006, 2007, when we were at the height of our troubles in Iraq, which, as you point out, have continued. I was talking to a very senior Pentagon official, aide to Donald Rumsfeld. He was at lunch with me, kind of giving me a briefing on what was happening in Anbar, the western province of Iraq, which was a mess. And I turned to him and I said, "You mean to tell me we're losing?" And he said, "I'm not only telling you we're losing, we're on the wrong side." And I thought, holy cow, that's an incredible mistake. And you're right, it is a mistake that keeps on giving. And Saddam Hussein just didn't think we were going to come and get him, precisely because of the Iranian threat. Well, here we are. I understand that our government believes that Iran is a threat, but I think it's an exaggeration to say, as many do, as we're all inclined to believe, that we kind of turned Iraq over to the Iranians. These are quite different people. The Iraqis are Shias like the Iranians, but they're Arabs. And sooner or later, and perhaps sooner than we think, they're going to ask the Iranians to leave. And if they don't leave, they're going to fight them. Now, you know, do we want to get in the middle of that one, as we've gotten in the middle of everything else in the Middle East? It just doesn't pay. It's not our fight. It's not our fault. And frankly, we can't fix it. So I think that the drumbeat that you're going to begin hearing from the military is, it's time to end these wars, and it's time to retool our diplomacy and think very clearly about what the nation's priorities are.
But it seems, though, even though the Saudis and the Iraqi government of Abadi apparently are starting to talk, and that this is something that Tillerson managed to broker, it does seem, though, that both the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and the young, impetuous boy king, yes, MBS, in Saudi Arabia, it's almost as if they want the Americans to go and fight and die in a war against Iran at their behest.
Well, you know, having had me on before and having read, you know, my work, how I feel about that. It could be that we have a president who's willing to bite that off or to try to digest that. But I think that cooler heads around him will prevail. Now, Secretary James Mattis, a four-star Marine, retired, doesn't like Iran, not even a little bit, and has consistently called them a malign influence in the Middle East. But I get no sense from him, and I don't hear anything from those around him, that he actually wants to take them on militarily and believes doing so would be foolish. So the question is, you know, with Netanyahu and, as you say, the young and impetuous MBS, who is Trump going to listen to? Is he going to listen to Jim Mattis, or is he going to listen to those who are beating the drums of war? My hope is that he leans on and learns from and listens to Jim Mattis. So far, so good, but we're only at the beginning of this process.
But isn't there a bit of a wild card there with having Eric Prince and his mercenary army in the Emirates? I know they're mostly doing contract work for the Chinese, but Bannon, of course, is no longer in the White House, but he's certainly proving to be a real thorn in the side of the so-called Republican establishment. And it's hard to know whether Trump is behind him or not. It's more and more appears that Trump's actually
listening to him.
Exactly, and they have some kind of wag the tail type of relationship. But it wouldn't take much to spark a war in that region. The IRGC and their speedboats, they're a bunch of nutcases. And, you know, you get a little bit of a shootout going with them in the Straits of Hormuz. A couple of tankers get sunk. And then we got a massive global catastrophe on our hands, right?
Well, you put your finger on it. I think that, unfortunately, we're on a hair trigger. I keep waiting for us to draw back a little bit for the adults in the room, as they call them, to kind of calm things down. It never quite seems to happen. I think that that an accidental confrontation between Iran and the United States is actually much more dangerous than what's happening in North Korea. I could be wrong, but I think that we're headed that way unless we take some very significant steps to head it off.
Well, that's really saying something, because just the other day I spoke with Ambassador Donald Gregg, who used to be the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and he was George H.W. Bush's national security advisor when he was vice president under Reagan. And he's absolutely alarmed about the situation in North Korea. He talks to the North Koreans and says you can talk to them. He doesn't understand why our side doesn't talk to them. But he said, I'm more afraid of Donald Trump than I am of Kim Jong-un. So, you know, that's a pretty volatile situation. So to say that you think the situation with Iran is even worse, that's really something.
I think that the chance of a kind of a accidental confrontation is quite possible. That's what worries me. And we have boots on the ground in Iraq, and they're extremely vulnerable. They're outnumbered by the Iranians, and we have our Navy in the Persian Gulf. I mean, it is a very dangerous situation. And the rhetoric that is coming out of this administration isn't helping. We haven't been paying as much attention as Korea. But I think that the rhetoric is as alarming on Iran as it is on Korea. And I'm very worried. I think it's, I give it 50-50, which I think is way higher than it should be. But it's about 50-50 that there'll be some kind of a confrontation. And we have a trigger puller in the Oval Office, in my opinion, who's not inclined to listen to cooler heads, and that's a very deep problem.
Well, what do you think's going to happen, though, with the Kurds? I mean, they've been sold out a number of times. Henry Kissinger and the Shah sold them out. But they've proven to be the only reliable boots on the ground that the U.S. could find to fight the Islamic State. The Islamic State's now being rolled up both in Iraq and in Syria, where the Syrian Kurds are doing the heavy lifting. It looks as though now that they've lost their economic viability because they've lost Kirkuk, they've got tremendous hostility coming from Erdogan in Turkey, hostility from the Iranians they share a border with in the east. Now Baghdad's angry with them. I know that the Israelis have made enormous military and intelligence investments in Kurdistan. It looks like it's pretty shaky for the long term, even the short term.
It does look shaky, but I'm not a pessimist on the Kurdish issue. And the reason I'm not a pessimist is, unlike with Iran and unlike with North Korea, we have direct communications with them. And we've made our views known. And we know their leadership quite well. We have very good lines of communication into the Iraqi government. And we have a Secretary of State. Well, I know a lot of people are very skeptical of him. I think he's actually doing a very good job on this issue, who's trying to calm the tempers and roll back the rhetoric and make the American point of view here very well known. We would like Iraq to remain a single country. Now, that doesn't mean we're against Kurdish rights. We're not. There is a negotiated settlement here between the Kurds and the Baghdad government that is quite doable. And if we work a little hard on it, we could get it. And it would be acceptable to the Kurds. They have been good, strong allies. And we've depended on them in many places in the Middle East. We've helped them a lot, actually. We've had a mixed history with them, but recently we've helped them a lot. And they're inclined to listen to us. And I think that that's all to the good. I think that the wild card here is Israel, because there's no question that their prime minister wants to pick a fight with the Iranians, and the one way to do that is to get the Kurds on side and to bang the table and say Kurdish independence, and because the Iranians oppose it. Well, the Iranians do oppose it, But so should we. I think an autonomous area inside Iraq with guaranteed rights is probably the way to go on this, and I think we can accomplish that.
Well, that's what they had, but now they lost their economic viability by losing Kirkuk, and now the Turks are cutting off the pipeline. So we should have weighed in earlier and advised them not to have this referendum.
Well, from your mouth to policymakers' ears, I agree with you. Mm. We should have weighed in earlier, but we've made our views on this known. Mm-hmm. Yes, they've lost Kirkuk, but the oil revenues from Kirkuk are quite negotiable. They've been causing problems in Turkey, and Turkey has been causing a lot of problems for them. That's quite negotiable if we maintain on side with Turkey and maintain good relations with Erdogan. This is much more of a diplomatic problem. I can't think of one instance in which the United States could solve this militarily. We're always reaching for the hammer. In this case, this conflict, this incipient conflict, can be resolved diplomatically, and I think that's the preference of all sides.
Well, just in closing, Mark Perry, with a president that is impetuous and ignorant, and you say he's got a hair trigger, and he's certainly influenced by Netanyahu, not to mention Stephen Bannon and his buddy Eric Prince with his mercenary army. On top of that, you've got to look at the larceny going on, you know, with the Saudis bribing Jared and Ivanka. They gave her $100 million. And God knows what kind of financial arrangements are going on with Trump. He seems to be, his foreign policy is predicated upon which third world dictator he can shake down for money and build hotels. I mean, that's a big element. It's not just geopolitics. It's the Trump family business involved in all of this stuff.
Well, I want to be clear. I agree that we are in a very dicey situation and that American leadership is lacking. We've been lucky as a country. We've had good leaders, Washington and Lincoln and Roosevelt and Eisenhower. We've had good, and Reagan. We've had good leaders when we needed them, and now we don't. And this is going to be really difficult. And we could be facing a domestic, and I think we are facing a domestic crisis where we're going to have to figure out a way to remove the president. And this situation could get much, much worse. I think that the hope is that we've gotten through tough situations before, and that we're now starting to see a realization on the part of leaders in the Senate, at least, who are willing to take this on. It's just the beginning. We've got a long ways to go. We don't have much time, but it's a beginning. And, I remain pessimistic about the short term, but in the long term, let's hope that the adults prevail.
Well, Mark Perry, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry. He's an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. And his latest book just out is The Pentagon Wars. And he has an article at Politico, Are Trump's Generals in Over Their Heads? And another at The American Conservative, How Saddam Hussein Predicted America's Failure in Iraq. We're going to take a restation break. We'll be back looking into a country that most Americans just learned the U.S. military is involved in, Niger.
Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ambassador David Litt, who is Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Niamey. Is it Niamey?
It would be Niamey.
Niamey, who was Deputy Chief of Mission in Niamey, Niger, from 1990 to 1993, and a State Department political advisor to the U.S. Special Operations Command from 1998 to 2002. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Why is the United States in Niger Anyway? Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador David Litt.
Thank you very much, Ian. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much. And the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dunford, did a lengthy press conference the other day at which he himself expressed some frustration that the information about what really happened in Niger has been dripping in, and he didn't have a lot to say about, wasn't able to answer a lot of the questions. But at this point, what we're learning apparently is that there was two special operations teams very close by, the one that got ambushed suffered the casualties was one of them, but there was a more sort of deep cover JSOC team, Joint Special Operations Command team, that was also operating along with French, and that was a mixed special forces and intelligence civilian operation. And apparently they were able to, they had a drone with them, they were able to send the drone to see what happened with the other the group that were ambushed. But in general, let's start with the cooperation with the French. And they of course, eventually sent in air cover, possibly and probably too late, but at least they had the military assets. So what is the relationship with the French there, in, as far as you know, in Niger?
As far as I know, we have had excellent cooperation with our French coalition partners, and they are predominant in Niger, as they are in Mali and other parts of West Africa where they were the former colonial power and retained strong interest in, influence, and ties with those countries at all levels. So there is a predominance of French influence in those countries, especially in Niger. I don't know precisely how close French special operations forces or French military, more broadly speaking, work with American military there, because I'm retired and I'm not part of the State Department. But I can easily imagine that our cooperation, as it has been across the board in many parts of the world, but in particular Francophone Africa, has been excellent.
Well, apparently what they were looking for, and I'm not sure about the Special Forces, Green Berets who were ambushed, but the JSOC team apparently, according to NBC News, were looking for Abu Walid al-Zawahiri, who apparently leads a sort of ISIS-affiliated jihadi group known as al-Murabatun. Their leader apparently called the Marlborough Man has reportedly been killed many times. But there is that essentially what the strategy is here, to sort of find the jihadi leader? Because obviously the other team that were ambushed were set up by the local villagers. They were asking about somebody. I'm not sure whether it was this particular character, al-Zawahiri. But in general, is that our strategy so far, to just sort of go after the so-called high-value targets?
I couldn't really say. I don't really know. It has been in the past that high-value targets are important elements of any extremist groups in order to undermine those groups' ability to function across borders, through the internet, or however they communicate with each other, even by courier or whatever it may be. But I'm confident also that part of the operations of U.S. military, in particular special operations, is to improve the capacity of host nation forces to be able to carry out military operations, design military operations, carry them out, because they are best informed and best able to do the kinds of operations in remote parts of the world that they know best. They speak the languages, they know the people, they can interact in villages and towns much more effectively than the United States can. But, of course, that in part, we do have U.S. military there for operations that that the commands, whether it's Africa Command or Special Operations Command, decide that we need American forces for.
But on the other side, arguably, that the fact that this whole area is racked with poverty, with weak governance, and with these insurgent movements, I mean, it does seem that the broad landscape is one that's a fairly fertile ground for recruiting jihadi, or whether it's al-Qaeda or ISIS.
This is the bottom line, absolutely right, that wherever governance is weak, wherever citizens don't feel that they have the that their government has their best interests at heart, or worse, putting them at severe disadvantage, or through corruption, or other types of misgovernance, that is where extremist groups can best hide out, can best recruit, and get their point across to populations. Because after all, it is the populations in which they dwell that they can best develop their own kinds of legitimacy through their false promises and false hopes. So therefore, it is incumbent on other nations who assist Niger or Mali or Nigeria or others to assist in their building credibility, legitimacy, and sovereignty in parts of their country that otherwise might suffer from a lack of governance and those kinds of views from the population.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador David Litt, who was Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Niamey, Niger, from 1990 to 1993, and a State Department political advisor to U.S. Special Operations Command from 1998 to 2002. And he has an article of Foreign Policy, Why is the United States in Niger Anyway? Now, just looking at the map, of course, Niger is surrounded by a number of countries, Benin, Burkina Faso, Mali, Algeria to the north, Libya to the north, and then to the east, Chad, and then to the south, Nigeria. Nigeria, of course, is beset with Boko Haram, and I take it that there's been a spillover into Niger from Boko Haram, and the U.S., now that we've, after this loss of these special forces, these Green Berets, we've learned that actually the U.S. presence in Niger is one of the biggest in terms of military training assistance. But the Niger military is pretty weak, I understand. Conversely, the military in Chad apparently is much more trained and professional. But we've just put Chad on the sort of terrorist list, which has not exactly endeared them to us, has it?
Most likely not. I haven't heard direct responses out of I've not read any or heard any direct responses out of Chad, but I can imagine that they are probably just as bewildered as many observers of foreign policy are why we should be targeting a country like Chad that is both poor, struggling to be a stable force in the region, and assisting its neighbors to deal more effectively with the extremist forces like, as you mentioned, Boko Haram and others that all of these countries potentially will suffer from. So Chad is one of the team. And whether I have never seen any credible motive for putting them on a list of countries who should not be eligible for visas for the United States. If there is an issue, as I have read, with passport paper or or some other law enforcement issue, I'm sure we could deal with that in a proper way. But just to put them willy-nilly on the list doesn't seem to me to make much sense at all when we have larger issues at stake for U.S. national security interest in the region.
Well, the latest travel ban, of course, also put to North Korea, and there's not exactly a lot of travel between North Korea and the United States. North Korea was put on the list along with Venezuela, and a lot of critics of the administration think that that was simply a way to take the onus off the idea that it was a Muslim travel ban. But Chad, which you're puzzled about, I'm puzzled about, because obviously it's right in the middle of where, for example, Senator Lindsey Graham the other day seemed to think that this could be the next theater, and he even went so far as to say that the next 9/11 attack could come out of Central and West Africa. So what do you think of that warning?
I think we should, the United States should always be vigilant about parts of the world that extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State organization will try to insert themselves into in order to find a safe space for them to plan, rest, recuperate, recruit, and so on, as they have done in so many other parts of certainly of the Middle East and of Africa, but in other parts of the world as well. And I don't think we can do a very good job of predicting where the next location for insurgent extremists is likely to be, and it is for that reason that U.S. policy, in my view, is best served by having our diplomatic and development cadres work very diligently in countries that that exhibit local conflict, perhaps underneath the surface, help them to build capacity to deal with their own conflicts and to deal with economic and social development so that they will not become future havens for terrorists. It's that kind of foresight across the board that will help America be more safe, not just try to chase after extremists and only try to assist in countries that are already infected with extremism.
Well, in your article, Ambassador Litt, at Foreign Policy, Why is the United States in Niger Anyway? You talk about the time that you were there in the early 1990s when the leader of Niger took an unusual political step for an African nation where he actually came to the U.S. and other embassies in Niamey asking for help to actually make his country more pluralistic, more democratic, more stable, etc. That's not the trend normally with the so-called strongman in Africa. How's it doing, to put it bluntly?
I think Niger is doing about as well as one can hope, given the dearth of resources and the weak infrastructure that Niger still suffers from. But is at least has developed some of the foundations for participatory democracy, that is to have citizens participate, citizens across the board participate in all areas of their lives, economic, social, and political, and to have built certain institutions that are relatively transparent. It is still very much of a tribal society. It still is a society that that suffers from a lack of resources, in natural resources, and has the bases for some accountability for those officials that transgress the rule of law or the expectations of the citizens for them to follow norms of the society. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, and it's this kind of experiment that requires constant assistance and vigilance by partners and donors of countries like Niger to continually work with them according to plans that the Nigerian government itself wants to have, and consonant with listening to civil society so that if there are dissenting views, they can be heard, and that too is a critical part of society, as we're witnessing in places like Spain and elsewhere, the Kurdish populations of Iraq, for example. So it is that kind of constant assistance and vigilance from Niger's partners and collaborators in economic development that will help continue to push it up the ladder of human development.
But in general, in that part of the world and in much of the world, it seems it's easier to get hold of an AK-47 assault rifle than it is to get a job.
Yes, getting weapons is often a lot easier than getting a job, and being in a developing country, that's not the only place where that kind of phenomenon is present. But that is part of the institutional challenge for any government anywhere to provide gainful, useful, valuable employment for its citizens, to give them the kind of education that will ultimately lead to careers inside their own country, where they will not only grow themselves and provide for their families, but also help their communities, their provinces, and ultimately their nation to progress. It's a very complex, intertwined set of processes that just take a long, long time to develop. And how you eliminate guns, for example, the AK-47 that you rightly mentioned is ubiquitous. It's traded far too easily around the world, and that is an effort of law enforcement, of border protection forces, and the United States, for example, does provide assistance, or at least did in the past. I'm not sure what the situation is today. Provide assistance to certain nations in learning how better to protect their borders from illicit trafficking, whether it's of humans or arms or drugs or whatever that may be.
Well, just in closing, Ambassador David Litt, you mentioned Iraqi Kurdistan, which has suffered a great setback with the Iranian-backed Iraqi militias taking Kirkuk, which is the economic lifeline for the Kurdish Iraqi state, and now it's now not viable. It's surrounded by enemies, Iran and Turkey, and now Baghdad. And many analysts are suggesting that the U.S. wasn't sufficiently vigilant in watching the situation, because we're so understaffed, both on the National Security Council and at the State Department and in the Pentagon as well, that we weren't able to dissuade the Iraqis the Kurds from this reckless vote of independence, which has created this blowback. That's just one of the many theaters where you keep hearing reports that we are suffering in terms of our ability to deal with these crises around the world. We don't have an ambassador in South Korea, for example, where there is a lot of tension with North Korea. We don't have, I believe, in West Africa, we don't have a Secretary of State for West Africa. And we certainly don't have anybody on the National Security Council with that portfolio. And you could go through a number of other regions of the world to find that we are just lacking in not being staffed up at DOD, at the NSC, and at the state.
I completely agree that the United States suffers tremendously in the execution and implementation of diplomacy when we are so thinly staffed at the middle management and senior levels as we are today. We have a lot of foreign service officers who are in acting positions, which is fine for foreign service officers, but you do need to have that connected flow of policy recommendations up and down, and a more fluid implementation of our policy not only up and down in the bureaucracy, but in and out of the United States, out to embassies, back from embassies into the Washington national security infrastructure. It is a situation that I believe should have been remedied certainly at the level of the leadership of our regional bureaus, that is the Assistant Secretary for Africa, the Assistant Secretary for the Near East, the Assistant Secretary for East Asia, and so on. Those positions are now just slowly being staffed, and there are a variety of reasons why that hasn't happened, which you could probably go into in a different session. But suffice it to say that the State Department must be fully staffed at a senior level in order to get the most out of our diplomatic service and to feed into the national security infrastructure. I would say that the Kurdish situation has its own dynamic and may or may not have been aided had we had people in place. That's another story that goes back to the days of the occupation, where Kurds, Shia, and Sunni Arabs had the responsibility to make decisions according to the constitution about the distribution of and the authorities over the oil infrastructure, how decisions would be made, and so on, and the status of Kirkuk and land tenure, and all sorts of things that just had not been done, and we arrived at today in a state of affairs in which they really need to get back to making those decisions collaboratively among themselves for the benefit of Iraq.
Well, Ambassador Litt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador David Litt, who's a Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Niamey, Niger, from 1990 to 1993, and the State Department Political Advisor to the U.S. Special Operations Command from 1998 to 2002. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Why is the United States in Niger Anyway? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.